Last year, the zoo also opened its biggest development to date, the Southeast Asia Jungle Track, including a climate-controlled tropical dome, high canopy rainforest area and tropical swamp. Director Kevin Bewley has worked in the zoo industry for nearly 25 years, including as head of zoo programs at Chester Zoo and also on Jersey with Gerald Durrell. And he's with me now. Tropical swamp, I bet it was swampy.
Kia ora, Kim.
Good How
morning.
Are you?
I'm very good. It's great to be here, but feeling a little bit guilty that I'm in Wellington.
You're in Wellington. And zoo's in Auckland. How's it going?
I think to say unprecedented, my mum, one might even use the word biblical in terms of what the zoo faced last night. So I was in regular contact with the team throughout the evening. And so many of your listeners will know that we've got the creek that runs through the zoo, which most of the time on a nice summer's day, it's an idyllic brook that runs through and you can see the fishes in it and everything like that. But when the stormwater comes down that creek. And so by about 7:30 last night, it broke the banks, has been hitting the bridges hard. And at some points in the zoo last night, we were chest deep in water. So some of the buildings in the lower half of the zoo have been flooded. Incredible team effort last night, making sure that the animals were safe.
Are they all safe?
Yeah. So we had to relocate some of them from the lower points. So some of our skinks and the alligators, which in that area adjacent to the creek. But fortunately, everything and everybody safe. So it's now just a matter of assessing damage this morning and a massive clear up operation. And so we've made the decision to close this weekend. Which I know it will be disappointing for people, but I'm sure a lot of people have got other things on their mind this morning in Auckland.
I don't think people will be travelling around this weekend much.
No.
Neither they should be. I get the impression I've been a fascinating book, 100 Years, 100 Stories, Century of Wildlife at Auckland Zoo. I get the impression that you really want to get over the message that zoos ain't what they used to be.
Some zoos ain't what they used to be, I think is the best way of putting that.
There are bad zoos.
Yes, dysfunctional zoos, bad zoos, frame it as you will.
We've all been to some bad zoos, right?
We have, and in many ways that coloured my early years and my view of what zoos were. I didn't like zoos when I was growing up. When I went to university, I had no intention of working in a zoo. But what I saw going to Gerald Durrell's place in Jersey many years ago, where I started my career.
My family and other animals, of course.
Exactly, yeah. But what he did is redefine the paradigm of what a zoo should be. So focused on conservation and science. And that's where I learnt my craft and my trade. And in many years, had some of the most exciting times of my life.
Did you meet him?
No, it wasn't anything to do with me, but he actually died the month I arrived. So he had had a liver transplant a few months earlier, and that hadn't taken well, and so he died long before his time, unfortunately. Hugely influential, even today, and the organisation he built still punches very much above its weight in terms of global conservation efforts and in many ways defining what a good modern zoo should do.
I'm considerably older than you, but I loved zoos because the family treat for us was to go to Chester Zoo, where you were.
I were.
And Chester Zoo was quite a pioneer in creating natural environments for the animals.
Exactly. So I've been very fortunate in my career to work at two of the leading zoos in the world. And George Mottershead, who set up Chester Zoo, I think it was in the 30s, took very much Gerald Durrell's view of creating spaces for animals where, you know, let's be truthful about it. There are a lot of zoos in the world that shouldn't exist. And I'll go as far to say that probably 90% need to be shut down or drastically improved. And so when you consider there's 10,000 things that call themselves zoos, whether that's wildlife parks, zoos, sanctuaries, they call themselves by different names, but effectively if you're caring for animals are dependent on human care, you're a zoo, right, by any other name. And there are a lot of bad zoos out there, and understandably large proportion of our community will still have a problem with zoos because the majority of them are bad. if you went to restaurants or hotels and you had a bad experience and saw horrible things or ate horrible food, you wouldn't, you'd stop going to zoos and to restaurants and hotels, wouldn't you? And so, so the challenge for us in recent years, as good modern zoos, as accredited zoos, that's one of the keys. So there's 1,000 accredited zoos on the planet.
What do you have to do to be accredited?
So it's, accreditation is basically somebody looking at what you're doing externally and saying, actually, from an animal care perspective, from a conservation perspective, from an education science perspective, what you're doing is good. And so uniquely, Auckland Zoo is accredited not just by the Australasian Association of Zoos and Aquariums, but also by the European Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And that puts us in part of a much larger family, a much larger zoo community. And so accreditation is key, and the 1,000 accredited zoos on this planet are now more important than ever. The issue we're facing, of course, is the bad zoos. We will be defined continually by our lowest common denominator and what people see on social media and read in the press about what bad zoos do. And so I don't want to change Auckland Zoo's name from zoo to something else. I want to redefine what being a good zoo means, and that's really been the journey of the last quarter of a century for us.
The book is about a lot of things. I read it a while ago. I'm just going through the pages. I've got turned down. This one is empowering consumers to help save tropical rainforests. The zoo's journey, championing certified sustainable palm oil. Mm. Are you sure it's certified sustainable? Are you sure it's sustainable? I mean, palm oil, it's easy. You couldn't do without it, could you?
Well, so I think that's the crux of the issue, right? There's too many of us buying too many things. And our reliance on refined products, on artificial products, on, you know, whether it's soaps in plastic bottles rather than bars of soap in the olden days, we're consuming too much stuff. And so nothing is sustainable on this planet at the level at which we're consuming it. So you're looking for the least bad option. And in many ways, palm oil, because of the amount of space it requires and the yield from the crop, is the least bad option.
That's where things get complicated, isn't it? Because Amy Robbins, who's Yuzu's deputy curator, she says research shows that oil palms yield 4 to 10 times more oil per hectare than any other vegetable oil.
Yep.
And so you need less land to produce the same amount of oil.
But that land is still land that should be tropical forest.
Yeah.
Should still have orangutans in it, should still have rhinos in it, should still have tigers in it, but it's not. It's been turned over to palm oil. But if we don't then have sustainable palm oil as an option, given the rate at which people are consuming it on this planet, then we're going to other options such as soy, which uses much more land, will start and is indeed continuing to destroy other parts of rainforests in Africa and South America. And so the fundamental issue is around excessive consumption of stuff. And so what you're doing is looking for the least bad option. And in the current situation we're in, palm oil, sustainable palm oil, where you're not destroying virgin forest, where you're producing that crop sustainably, is the least bad option.
Aren't you a frog expert?
A frog expert. I think that's going back to when I was little. So you said you're older than me, but not by much, I don't think. I started off as what one might term a herpetologist.
Herpetologist.
So that's basically somebody that has an uncomfortable passion for amphibians and reptiles. And yes, as I say, started my career in Jersey and had unique opportunities there to work with species that nobody else was working with on the planet at that time. So a lot of species from the Caribbean, including species such as the mountain chicken frog, third largest frog in the world. So I'm showing you now about, you know, dinner plate type size it can grow up to. And that species was threatened as a result of volcanic activity on Montserrat, and also the emergence of a chytrid fungus disease that's wiped out a third of amphibians on this planet in recent years. And so we were caring for the first time for that species in Jersey Zoo many years ago, and we worked out how it bred. And that's still one of the most memorable things that of my entire career is coming into the zoo that morning, reviewing the video footage of those animals in their nighttime burrow, and for the first time seeing like tadpoles being fed by their mother. This is frogs. This is not like mammals. So mum feeds her tadpoles with retained eggs. So the tadpoles eat eggs from mum's bum, basically.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, and so nobody knew this before, right?
Really?
And so I was the first person on the planet to see this. And what happens as a result of discovering these things, of discovering frog reproductive technologies and things where you have maternal care and recruitment of that to that population, those babies going into the population in the wild are entirely dependent on that mum being there to care for them. The issue with the mountain chicken frog is it also used to be the national dish. And so it would be hunted, collected for food. Tastes like chicken.
Obviously, is that why it was called chicken?
I believe so.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And so the issue is, if you remove mums during the breeding season, then you get no recruitment to the population. So directly from that stuff we studied in the zoo, that those discoveries we made in the zoo, we were able to make recommendations to the governments in Montserrat and Dominica around, don't not hunt them, but hunt them at certain times of the year and do it in a sustainable way.
Somebody's texted me to say I was also brought up in Shropshire. If Chester Zoo was the good, Dudley Zoo was the bad. I have to say, we never went to Dudley Zoo. There's probably a good reason for that. Did you know Dudley Zoo?
I think I went once, and I'm not going to sit here and comment on other zoos in the UK.
Somebody else, I need to ask you about this, because I get some texts from adamant people. Auckland Zoo stream does not have any fish in it. It's majorly polluted. Please respond.
So the creek that runs through our zoo is not actually the responsibility of the zoo. It does indeed have fish in it at times, and they find their way down there from the main lake. But I would completely agree with your listener that it is not an ideal habitat for animals by any stretch of the imagination.
And should be improved. What's the problem with it?
I think you've got the central interceptor going in Auckland, and it's basically the growth of our city, the size of our city, the number of roads, the extreme weather events we're getting, and the ability of our infrastructure in a city to cope with it. So stormwater runoff and where that water goes when it hits us so hard like it did last night.
You've got Archie's frog as an area of study at Auckland Zoo.
Yeah.
And they are one of the two native frogs.
There's a few native frog species.
Endemic. One of the two endangered ones.
Yeah,
though.
So Archie's frog, we've had them for a number of years at the zoo, and over the course of that time have refined our husbandry and care of them to the point that we now can regularly and reliably breed them. The main issue, though, or the main focus of our work, in addition to the research work we do in the zoo, is working with the Department of Conservation with them in the wild and monitoring the remaining populations of them in the wild, which is an incredibly tedious task that's got to be done at night in all types of weather, and basically seeing how they're doing in the face of decreased habitat, in the face of introduced predators and emerging infectious diseases such as the chytrid fungus. And so it's an example of where many, many species in New Zealand now, all of our threatened ones, will only persist because of ongoing human care. The work that DOC does, the work that so many local community groups do, and the work that good zoos do. And what we're doing, the skills that are required to basically keep those species going in many ways are the types of skills, the intensive management skills that good zoos have been perfecting for decades. And so one of the hugely appealing things as a person from the UK moving out to New Zealand was this opportunity to do what we'd been doing in Jersey so many years ago, which is to take our zoo skills out into the wild and conserve and save species in the wild.
And you work very closely with the Department of Conservation in New Zealand and also conservation groups elsewhere in the world, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So what are you doing with the Department of Conservation?
So I think what we've done is evolve that relationship over many years, and we're hugely proud of the work we do with them. And what we've got effectively is a complementary skill set. So the things that DOC are really, really good at and well practiced at, and then because increasingly as habitats shrink and population sizes shrink, there is an increased dependence on human skills to keep species going. So whether that's removing eggs for hand rearing, whether that's head starting species, whether that's moving small populations around metapopulation management to keep the genetics healthy, whether that's monitoring populations in the wild. So that sort of complementary skill set that we have as zoo professionals, we work with DOC on identify priority projects to make the whole greater than the sum of the parts, as it were. And it's been an incredibly fulfilling relationship, and one that I hope will grow in years to come, because certainly there are so many species in our country that desperately need our help.
Right, and you don't want people to not only look at animals that are endemic to New Zealand, but also animals from overseas and think, well, there's one, so we're all right. You want them to encourage people to care about where they naturally live,
yeah,
habitats.
Absolutely. So the issue we're facing now is that in the last 50 years, right, so half the time that the zoo has been in existence, we've lost two-thirds of the planet's wildlife. So in my lifetime, two-thirds of the planet's wildlife is gone.
And you mean numerically or species?
Well, both. So I bandied these numbers around, and you can read different papers on it, but that's a good number to remember, right? Half a century, two-thirds of our species gone. Mm. It's not precisely accurate. We're losing species now that have never been discovered, all right? Because habitats are being destroyed at a rate where scientists haven't gone in and discovered species that have lived there for millions of years. They've gone. And so we are in the midst of the sixth mass extinction. We're not about to go into it. We're in a climate crisis, and you've only got to look what happened in Auckland overnight. And so we're on a path at the moment that doesn't necessarily have a great outcome. And this is where zoos, good zoos, have a more important role than ever before, because zoos are not going to change things around on their own, but the people that visit zoos, good zoos, can. Whether that's individual actions, community actions, whether it's putting pressure on government, local government, central government, whether it's putting pressure on large corporations. Your earlier guest, was it Tim Jackson? Mm. And that whole shift in the paradigm of how we operate as a species on this planet.
Such a shift, though.
With 8 billion
where
people.
Where do you start?
Exactly. And it's, anyway, it's incredibly challenging retaining optimism and hope in the face of this stuff, but it's the small actions, the small successes that we have that give you hope that things can turn around. So, you know, we've got two species of skink in this country now that would be extinct were it not for Auckland Zoo and were it not for the efforts of DOC. All right, so two species on the west coast of the South Island that we rescued, that we brought into the zoo, that we bred, and one of them has now gone back into a new habitat in the wild. Those species would be extinct. All right, so it's those little wins, and importantly, the way in which you can see the community tide changing. There is change happening. Our challenge is to make it happen quick enough that we can stop the rot, as it were.
You got one elephant.
Mm.
Didn't want it. Tried to get rid of it.
Oh, that's a bit harsh,
that
isn't it?
That fell over.
I wouldn't put it that way, but
no,
yeah.
I know you wouldn't.
So Burma is still with us, and we love her very much, and in many ways, it was the most difficult decision I've ever made in my zoo career, and a very difficult one particularly for the team. But the decision ultimately came from the elephant team
to send her to Australia.
Yeah, so it was driven by the fact that, you know, our aspiration was in the long term to have a breeding herd at the zoo. But for various reasons, that didn't come off over a number of years, and the challenges.
I mean,
she's
part breeding, isn't she?
Yes, Burma is, but the Anjali, who she was with for a number of years, was very much a breeding age.
Right.
And it was Anjali's situation that prompted the decision to move Burma and Anjali on. So Anjali is now at Dubbo Western Plains Zoo, living with the breeding herd there, and our hope is very much that she'll have a calf of her own and be in that herd situation. The original plan was for Burma to go to a zoo in Australia.
And to have more company.
To have more company, to live out her life on the Sunshine Coast. But a week before that move was supposed to happen, everything was in place. The plug was pulled and we were left holding the elephant.
Why was it pulled?
Oh, so I don't know the full details of it. I still don't. And I don't think it's really for me to comment on another zoo. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, if they didn't want her, we don't want her to go to somewhere she's not wanted. And so the challenge for us now, obviously, is to find a home that meets her needs. In the meantime, she's doing fantastically well, and the team are used to looking after her on her own, as they did before, after Cashin died and before Anjali joined us. So she's doing really well. She enjoys walks in the bush up the hill. She's spoilt beyond belief. And until such time as we can find a new home for her, which is hopefully sooner rather than later.
Because you wanted to have company.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it's not possible to bring another elephant to be with her.
No, because that's not a sustainable situation, right? So another elephant coming to us would necessarily be a post-reproductive elephant. And so at some point, you still end up with one elephant again.
Yes.
And so that's why we made the really difficult decision that actually elephants at Auckland Zoo in the long term is not the right thing for us. But she's got to go to the right home. We've got to be absolutely confident she'll be with other elephants and that she will receive the best possible care. Otherwise, she stays with us because we know she's happy where she is.
One of the things that you try to imagine in this book is Auckland Zoo in 100 years' time.
That's me philosophising.
Yeah, well, what do you think? Tell me.
So I philosophised, if that's a word, that we go down two possible paths. And so how do I explain this in succinct words? In 1922, when we opened up, and everything that Auckland Zoo has always been well-intentioned, not necessarily well-informed, but well-intentioned. But in 1922, when we opened in December, on December the 16th, it was very much a menagerie. Right? It was before TV. It was before lots of colour books. Around and people hadn't seen a lot of these animals, and so it was a menagerie. People went for entertainment. Yes, there was learning. Yes, there was a bit of science there.
Yes, effectively, there were chimpanzees smoking cigarettes.
And yes, there was. Yeah, that was before my time. But effectively, we were a menagerie, right? Of species that people hadn't seen. If we don't get things right, as a species over the next 100 years, then the Auckland Zoo of 2122 is not going to be dissimilar, I think, to the one of 1922, i.e. there will be a whole load of extinct in the wild species in that zoo, the only place that people can see them, because we failed as a species. All right. My much more optimistic and hopeful scenario is that we've navigated a much, much more sustainable path as a species, that we've tackled climate change, that biodiversity decline has been arrested. And the Auckland Zoo of 2122 in that scenario still has a vital role to play in connecting a very urbanized population with wildlife. So you have to remain connected with wildlife and the environment to care about it. And that's part of the issue. We're one of the most urbanized countries on this planet. And as a result, there's a growing disconnect between us and the natural environment. And so a zoo of the future in a sustainable world will still have a vital role to play connecting people with wildlife.
Or
will be a menagerie.
Yeah.
To remnant species that we failed to save when there was still time.
Okay. So you have to keep your connections with the wider environment to be a conduit and an influence all the time.
Absolutely.
Good to talk to you. I hope when you get back to Auckland you find the zoo not too inundated and damaged.
Yeah, thank you very
by
much.
The floods. Kevin Bewley, who is director of Auckland Zoo, and there's a book called Auckland Zoo, 100 Years, 100 Stories, a century of wildlife at Auckland Zoo. As Kevin Bewley said, it opened in December 1922. Oh, somebody texts to say, keep Burma. She's